It was on one Monday morning, just about 1 o'clock, when the great Titanic began to reel and rock. Then the people began to cry, saying, Lord, we're gonna die. It was said when that great ship went down.
With this April marking the 100th anniversary of the Titanic's maiden voyage and sinking, we take time in this month's episode of the History Explorer podcast to hear from curator of maritime history, Paul Johnston, who discusses objects from the Titanic and its rescue that are now part of the collections here at the National Museum of American History.
It was sad when that great ship went down.
My name is Paul Johnston. I'm the curator of maritime history at the American History Museum at the Smithsonian, and I'm starting to get questions about Titanic now because we're about 2 months in advance of the 100th anniversary of the sinking of that famous ship. And I always like to, people say, what about Titanic? And I say, I never heard of it. What are you talking about? But that doesn't work anymore, unfortunately, because we are so close to the anniversary. And I don't know why, really, down deep, why people are so interested in the Titanic. It was not the worst marine disaster that's ever happened. Many more people have died in some of the military wartime shipwrecks, and it wasn't the first ship to go down on her maiden voyage, probably the Vasa, the Swedish flagship that went down in 1628, right in Stockholm Harbor, right after it left the quay, was more famous in its time. But Titanic has legs. It's really stuck to the collective imagination because of, I think, so many movies and so many books have been written about it, and articles and songs, and it's just really captured the popular imagination, maybe because of the sense of celebrity, all the famous people that died or were connected with the ship in one way or another. Maybe the sense of helplessness that people felt when they were thinking about, what if I'd been on board that and I'd hit an iceberg? The fact that shipwrecks are still happening all the time. In fact, just in the last few weeks, a couple of giant cruise ships have was foundering in the Indian Ocean right off the Seychelles a couple days ago and caught fire right in the middle of Piracy Alley, and then another one hit the coast of Italy. So these kinds of things are happening still all the time, but for some reason the Titanic has echoed, it's resonated in the public imagination for over 100 years, and there's still lawsuits over it, and there's still fascination with it. And a new version of James Cameron's famous movie is coming out, the 3D version, so it's still very popular, and it's interesting to follow that popularity through time and space, and here we are 100 years later, and it's still really exciting to people. When we were researching the maritime history exhibit on the water for the first floor of the American History Museum, we started canvassing all the different collecting units within this building. And we came up with some stuff and some stories that we really didn't know very well, that had never really hit the public imagination before. And one of the most interesting ones is a collection relating to a young girl named Bernie Palmer. In 1912, she was 16 years old, and she had just gotten a brownie, either for Christmas or for her January birthday. She didn't remember which. And then that spring, she and her mom decided to take a trip on the ocean liner Carpathia over to the Mediterranean. And of course, Carpathia was the ship that picked up the rescue of the Titanic passengers. And so she took her brand new brownie camera and started snapping pictures, not only of the survivors from Titanic, but also the so-called iceberg that actually Titanic had hit. Now, on the way back from the wreck site off the coast of Nova Scotia, Carpathia's Captain Rostron decided that he didn't have enough food for the 700-odd survivors that he picked up out of the ice water. And so he came back to New York, and he put a blackout on any kind of transmissions from ship to shore. So when the ship actually reached New York, several of the reporters were allowed on board, but only after the survivors had gotten off. And one of the reporters was walking around and saw this girl with her camera and started a conversation, and it turned out that she had some original pictures. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. If you let me have your cameras, I will get your pictures developed and give you prints, and also give you $10 for them if I could. And of course, she being a naive young girl didn't know any better. And so she handed over her camera and signed a contract. And then, of course, the reporter got exclusive rights to the pictures that she had taken on board the ship. And, of course, her father was furious when he found out that she had given them away for so little. But anyway, that made a kind of fun story. And she gave us not only the camera, but the original negatives and prints and the contract that she'd signed with Underwood & Underwood, the newspaper company that bought the pictures, in 1985. So that's kind of a fun story. Another cool group of things that we have are from one of the pioneers of early radio, a guy named Harry Cheatham. And he was born in the right around 1890, 1892. He got his first radio operator's license in 1911, and he was working for the Marconi Wireless Company in Boston, installing radio stations along the coast. And in fact, the Titanic had a Marconi radio station on it, as did Carpathia. In fact, these belonged not to the ship owners, but to the Marconi Company at the time. They were kind of contracted out to do that work. And since there was a blackout on any transmissions between Carpathia and the shore, other than survivor lists, so that the families would know what was going on, a Boston Globe editor hired Harry and another of the Marconi employees to go up to Gloucester and see if they couldn't, Gloucester, Massachusetts, and see if they couldn't intercept some of the transmissions between the ship and the shore. And sure enough, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, Harry was able to pick up a tale that President Taft's personal aide, a guy named Archie Butt, was not among the survivors. And so he got paid $175 for that scoop that they telephoned into the Boston Globe and was published the next morning. Shortly after Carpathia had done the rescue in New York, she was up in Boston. And since Harry was the local representative for the Marconi Wireless Company, he had to go on board and overhaul the radio system, which had actually broken down to some extent after the rescue attempt. So he went on Carpathia, and he was in the radio room, and he saw that there was a broken Leyden jar and an antenna switch that needed replacement. And so he replaced those on board and then removed those things, which had been damaged during the Carpathia rescue of Titanic. And then he saved those, and in 1930 he began giving the Smithsonian these and some of the other aspects of very early radio that he had in his private collection. One of the other objects that we have here at American History Museum from Titanic is one of the life vests, and that came from another passenger that was aboard Carpathia going over to the Mediterranean for a cruise, a guy named Dr. Frank Blackmar. And Dr. Blackmar, although he was just a passenger, he helped the Titanic survivors through their exposure and their freezing cold temperatures. And he had actually collected one of the life vests from a passenger and donated it to the Chicago Historical Society, and they passed it along to us back in 1982. And that's on exhibit down in the On the Water exhibit on the first floor of the American History Museum. Just a couple of weeks ago, I learned about one other object that we had down in the numismatics collection, and that was a 9-ounce gold medal that was donated in 1912 by the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission. And this was an outfit that, in fact, they're still doing their job today. They give recognition and medals to heroes of various kinds who might rescue people out of shipwrecks or car wrecks or burning homes or something like that. And this was set up by the famous philanthropist Carnegie back in the early days of the 20th century. And the impact on the public was so great that the Fund Commission, the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission, voted to create a big medal. And since they didn't have any specific hero to donate it to, they decided, well, we'll just give it to the Smithsonian. Of course, they did this without bothering to check with the Smithsonian to see if they wanted it or not at the time. But in fact, of course, they were happy to have it. And that just turned up in numismatics when the modern staff of the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission contacted us and asked where the medal was and was it available and could they see it and know how it was being treated here at the Smithsonian. So that was kind of a fun and very recent thing. And that's part of the fun of working here at the Smithsonian, is that you're always learning new things about the collections that may or may not have any relation to what you work on. But it's just interesting stuff to see. And you never know when you walk down to, for example, the photo lab, you might see one of Babe Ruth's baseballs being photographed, or you go to the paper conservation lab and you'll see the Jefferson Bible or something like that. And that's one of the great things about working at this place, I think. I think taken as a collection, these objects and other artifacts, some visual things, we have, for example, over 36 pieces of sheet music that came out during the period of, really in 1912 and in 1913. And they didn't have television, of course, or radio much in those days. And so people just used to sit around their parlors and play the piano and sing songs. And it sounds kind of sentimental now, but in fact, this was a major way of entertainment and social interaction among families and friends in some of the more urban neighborhoods and in the suburbs and more rural areas as well. And I think collectively all these things, every little one of these gave you a sense of, I think perhaps, there but for the grace of God go I, feeling, just like people today as you travel down the highway and you see something just as simple as a motorist changing his or her tire. There's slowing down, there's rubbernecking, and you know, that can really create a problem in transportation today. And I think that's sort of how people feel about the Titanic. It was a way for them to experience some of the disaster and the feelings that were felt by the people who were more directly involved without actually having to be involved yourself.
In the darkness of the night there came a crash, the crash of a doom, and the gallant crew soon realized the sea must be their tomb.
Thanks to Paul Johnston for taking the time to speak with us. For the History Explorer podcast, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Tune in again next month as we take another look behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Podcast made possible by a grant from the Verizon Foundation.